I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today on Change Surfer, we'll be listening to the first part of a speech by science fiction author and e-rights activist Cory Doctorow, delivered on February 18, 2006 at the Boscone SF Con in Boston, Massachusetts. He talks about the global legal and technological efforts to lock down digital rights and restrict personal and creative use of electronic materials. Cory contributes to the phenomenally entertaining blog Boing Boing at boingboing.net and writes for numerous publications. He's the former European Affairs Coordinator for the Electronic Freedom Foundation and is now a fellow at the EFF. His most recent novel is Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, and his website is craphound.com.
There's an old and much repeated story through the history of technology, which is the invention of new technologies that enable new forms of entertainment, new forms of culture, new forms of communication, and the response of entrenched industries, incumbent industries, to this stuff. And I'm starting with the first technologies for reproducing entertainment, which were the piano rolls. So the composers who made the sheet music that piano rolls piggybacked on, they were the only musicians. They were the only people who had a music industry, because they had this industrial practice. It was the practice of writing something in your room and then having it reproduced and generate revenue for you even after you were done with writing it. Right? Performers, by contrast, only made money while they were working. Right? Only made money while they were doing what I'm doing now, standing on a stage and talking to people or performing in front of people. And as a consequence, performers weren't considered particularly important to the music industry. All they did in the minds of the composers was follow instructions, right? The important thing about instructions isn't who follows them, it's who writes them down. And so when the sheet music industry began, or when the piano roll industry began, the phonogram industry began, what they would do is they'd go and buy some sheet music from Tin Pan Alley, and they would rip it to a computer tape, a long roll of brown computer tape called a piano roll. And it would be digitized in that as a series of zeros and ones, holes and solids on this that would be interpreted by a special purpose computer called a player piano that would play it back. And in this way, a performer could suddenly have an industry, whereas before it was only the composers. Now, the composers hated this. They argued that, first of all, that everyone who wanted to make a piano roll should be required to take a license from them, to license this work, and that secondarily, that they should be able to refuse licenses to people whom they didn't want a license to. And in the main, they didn't want a license to anyone because they didn't understand why it was that they should be signing, to their mind, their own death warrant, right? Encouraging people to come up with a new industrial practice that was different from their own, that created a different class of people who were in charge of the music industry. This culminated in about 1908 when John Philip Sousa, the great American composer, went to Congress and said, if these infernal talking machines are allowed to continue, we will not have a voice box left in America. We will lose our voice boxes as we lost our tails when we came down out of the trees. Now, many points to Sousa for being an early advocate of the still controversial theory of natural selection, if in a slightly Lysenkoan way. But here you have Sousa going to Congress and saying, you know what? We should be in charge of this, that our monopoly over who gets to copy our works should in fact be transmuted into a monopoly over who gets to design a device capable of copying our works, right? That we should be able to bootstrap that up into a much larger monopoly. And, oh, hey, John. as a consequence, in response, Congress came up with a principle that I think has stood us in good stead ever since, which is that if you break the dominant form of entertainment among your constituents, they won't vote for you again. So there are a lot of terrible things you can do to Americans. You can send them to die in foreign wars, and you can embezzle their tax coffers and so on. But take away their televisions, and you're in big trouble. This one's Change Surfer Radio. Actually, this one is a bomb. It's connected to a recorder. My God, there were only four mics, and now there's five. Duck. Just kidding. So, Congress breaking. Okay. So, the thing was that the people who had made their living from performance, or from composition, couldn't understand how they could make a living as performers. Now, not long thereafter, the performers had a comparable reaction to radio, right? The vaudeville players had a comparable reaction to radio, to the Marconi people. They characterized what was going on with Marconi, again, as a kind of institutionalized theft of their, the word intellectual property didn't exist at the time. A lot of people use this as though it's an old term. It's really just a couple of decades old. But it's people who were ripping off their copyrights. And because, of course, if you wanted to play music on the radio, what you'd have to do is take one of these phonograms, these discs that had been piracy a couple of decades before, and transmit it over the air, and they argued that you should have to take a license, they should be able to refuse the license, and so on. Now, what Congress had done with the sheet music people is they'd said, you know what, incumbents can't really be in charge of progress, because if that were the case, then, you know, blacksmiths would never authorize automobiles and so on, right? It's, you know, everyone wants to safeguard their racket. So instead what they said is, we compel you, we demand you. You know, the power of Congress compels you. You must license your compositions to anyone who makes sheet music, right? For anyone who gives you, or who makes a piano roll, anyone who gives you 2 cents gets the unlimited right to make a phonogram from your work. And for each phonogram, they have to give you another 2 cents. That's still in place today. The mechanical compulsory license is how Sid Vicious can record My Way without having to get permission from Anka, right? It's just a kind of straight up economic right, and it's not like a moral right or a right to prohibit or a right to exclude. It's just you know, you want to record a song, you record a song. You want to record punk bands doing Schoolhouse Rock, I've got a great CD of just that. You just pay the composer's royalties. If you want to record punk bands doing The Best of the Carpenters, you can do that too. That's another great CD, and so on. That's worked really well. So the phonogram people, though, they looked at radio and they said, this is outrageous. This is completely incorrect. You have no right to do this to us. And even when the radio people pointed out that if they had been offered a kind of blanket license, you know, a flat rate through which they could play whatever they wanted, which was eventually what prevailed in radio, that they could turn a buck for the composers or for the performers, the performers weren't buying it. Now, the pitch from the radio people was pure dot-com snake oil, right? So it's hard to blame them, right? It went like this. Sure, you've made every penny you've ever made by having a room like this and the bald man at the door business model, which is the bald man at the door with a lot of tattoos who will punch you in the head and throw you out if you don't buy a ticket, right? Sure, you've made every cent you've ever made this way. We have a new technology that takes you from a world where you have 100% control over who can see your performances and therefore 100% ability to seek rent on those performances to one where you have 0% control. Anyone who's 8-year-old can build or acquire a crystal set, can tune into our broadcasts of your works. However, we've got an answer to this, which is we are going to get a new form of statistical math that'll let us figure out who's listening to what, and we're going to get antitrust exemption from Congress that'll let us form a new kind of entity called a rights society, and we're going to get actors with good baritone voices to give insincere but sincere sounding testimonials to the values of different kinds of soap. And then we're going to take the soap money, divide it up with the new math, and disperse it using the antitrust exempted collection society, and 1,000 times more artists will get 1,000 times more money than they ever had before by making 1,000 times more art that'll reach 1,000 times more audiences, and we'll all be happy. And even after this crazy model, it became clear that it was going to work, even after it became clear that this, at least for all its failings, was substantially superior to having a $400 an hour lawyer talk to another $400 an hour lawyer to determine whether or not a particular cut was going to cost 15 cents or 20 cents to play on the air every time the DJ wanted to drop the needle, the vaudeville performer still had a substantial objection. It went like this. We are charismatics. We stand on the stage, and we do something as old and holy as the first story told in front of the first fire in the first cave. You have no right to demand of us that we become mere clerks who sit in back rooms and produce work that you then take and present to our audiences on our behalf, right? We are artists. We are not to be clerks, right? Well, they were right to a certain extent. They were right in that the thing that determined how good you were if you were a performer was your charisma, right? If you were a live performer, it was your charisma. We've all seen buskers who actually weren't very good at their instruments, but had a lot of moxie and were pretty fun to watch, right? Those are charismatic performers. The problem is that charisma doesn't carry very well on a phonogram or on a radio broadcast, right? What you really need for those kinds of transmissions is virtuosity. Right? It's raw skill. And we've all, of course, seen very virtuoso performers who had no charisma, who came out and stood like a lump. And, you know, in writing, in novel writing, this is endemic, right? We've all gone to readings from writers who are beautiful writers. I mean, just the words on the page are glib and fantastic, and they flow like champagne. And then you come and you give it, and it's as though their manuscript has been typed with boxing gloves on, right, when they actually deliver the talk. So you know, technology gave and technology took away. What it did was, when we came to an era where virtuosity was the thing that determined it, was it preferred those people who are virtuosos, not those people who are performers, so who are charismatic. So the charismatics are there saying, you have no right to do this, you have no right to turn us into mere clerks, we are charismatics. Now, 70 years later, their spiritual descendants have turned up and said, our phonograms are being redistributed without our control, right? These works are being distributed all over the internet. We have no mechanism for controlling it. And those of you who say to us, well, you can do as Phish and the Grateful Dead and other bands have done, and use these as a lure to bring people into a room where you can go back to the ball guy at the door business model, that might be right as far as it goes. Certainly it worked for the Grateful Dead and Phish and so on, but who are you to say that we are to be trained monkeys who caper on a stage, right? We're not charismatics. We're white-collar workers. We work indoors. We commune with our muse, and when we're done, we open the door and deliver it to our audience. You have no right to tell us that we have to be charismatics, right? Technology giveth and technology taketh away, and the history of technology goes like this again and again. So you have the radio people finally legalized this act of Congress and this protracted negotiation, and you know, so they had ripped off the phonogram pirates who'd ripped off the sheet music people, and then along comes cable, and the radio broadcast industry, the broadcast industry goes, well, that's a form of piracy. Right, because what they're doing is they're putting an antenna up and they're slurping in all the broadcasts at the head end and retransmitting them over the wire without permission, without compensation, in order to turn a buck, right? And of course, you know, we demand that they license it from us, and we demand the right to refuse licenses to them, and we're never going to license to them because that's just cutting our throat, right? And again, Congress comes along and they say, well, you know, I'm sorry, I think that as between upsetting you and breaking television, the thing that's going to be best for my career is not breaking television. Hey, presto, compulsory license. Anyone who transmitted anything over television airwaves is compelled by law, the power of Congress compels you, to license your work to people who operate cable television stations. And again, that's still in place today. So, sheet music people ripped off by the phonogram people, ripped off by the radio people, ripped off by the cable people, who were ripped off by the VCR people, who came up with mechanisms for time shifting and so on. And of course the court said, well, that's going to be permitted. Congress actually didn't respond to this, or rather they responded in a new way. What they said was, I'm not going there, right? Let's let some people who don't have to worry about re-election, you know, people with lifetime appointments like Supreme Court justices, cope with this. And the Supreme Court in the decision about legalizing VCRs said at the end of the day, our decision is based on the law written today. It may not be the right law, but if it's going to change, Congress has to change it. And here we are. You know, if that was 1984, it's 2006. Congress hasn't changed it, right? There is a deadlock when it comes to breaking people's televisions. Now, during the television wars, Jack Valenti, who is the talking Gila monster on behalf of the entertainment industry, Jack went to Congress in 1982 at UCLA at hearings on the legality of the VCR, and he gave this speech where he did these remarkable things. The first thing he did was he said, the VCR is a ploy by the Japanese who have destroyed our auto industry and are now gunning for the last great American industry with their infernal copying machines by the entertainment industry. And he said, and this is a great city to recount this in, he said that the VCR is to the American film industry as the Boston Strangler is to a woman home alone. completely wrong, and yet the entertainment industry solidly refuses to repudiate this. Every time I give a talk like this in a policy venue where there's someone from the entertainment industry present, usually an MPA or MPAA representative, they always come up to me afterwards and they say, when will you people lay off that Boston Strangler remark? It was 22 friggin' years ago, 24 friggin' years ago. And And I say, well, do you disagree, right? Did your president lie to Congress? Have you gone to Congress to correct the record? I mean, you've had lots of testimony. You give this annual report called the Content Protection Status Report to the Senate. Have you ever put in a little, introductory formatter that says, remember in 1982 when we gave that testimony about the Boston Strangler? We were wrong. Now, you know, they haven't, in fact. And Jack Valenti on his exit interview with James Grimmelman when he left the MPAA to retire, when they asked him about this, he said, no, I stand behind it. I was absolutely right. And of course, the new building in D.C. that the MPAA has just built, beautiful building, is called the Jack Valenti building. So you might hear people from the entertainment industry occasionally say, well, that was 24 years ago. If they do, I encourage you to say, do you disagree? Have you changed your mind? So technology giveth, technology taketh away. Copyright is continually out of step with technology because copyright's a technology regulation and technology moves faster than regulators can. And we have this traditional life cycle of the copyright statute, which is new technology is invented, it's unlawful because it wasn't countenanced in the statute. New statute is written that accommodates the technology and balances the interests of the people who need it. This time it's different. This time we have new things on the line, and this time it doesn't look like we're going to get a rebalancing. And I think that it's something that we all need to be quite concerned about. This time we have copyright being bootstrapped not just into a monopoly over who gets to design technologies capable of copying copyrighted works and diffusing them and so on. We're getting intrusions into things like what is a contract, what is a family, areas that copyright law has never touched. And I'm going to get into that in some detail in a minute. So one area where all of these technologies where all of these collisions are really coming up is in what's called free and open source software. Free and open source software is technology that is like proprietary software, like Windows and so on. I'm sure most of you are familiar with this stuff. Windows is proprietary software. Free and open source software is just like Windows, except in addition to getting the code that runs Windows, you also get the code necessary to make a program that runs Windows, and you get a license allowing you to modify, now understand, improve upon, and distribute your changes to that code. Now, if this sounds familiar, it's because we have a historic name for it. We call it the Enlightenment, right? For 500 years, what passed for science was alchemy. And as those of you who've read Stevenson's magnificent trilogy know, for 500 years, every alchemist discovered for himself the hard way that drinking mercury was a bad idea. And we call that period the Dark Ages. And at the end of the Dark Ages, an alchemist published, right, and told his colleagues what he'd discovered. And that tradition, which we now call the scientific method, gave rise to the Enlightenment. Now, I'm not saying that commercial industry has an obligation to follow the method. Obviously not. We have scientists who follow the method, and we have industry that doesn't, and we have incentives to kind of produce method-like outcomes from the industry, like we give people patents if they'll disclose how their technologies work, specifically to advance this thing that's been in place since the Enlightenment, the natural philosophers. However, we should allow academe and individuals, scientists and naturalists, to pursue the scientific method. Now, the thing that embodies the biggest risk to the scientific method is something called digital rights management technology. These are technologies that restrict how you can use works after you lawfully acquire them. So if you've ever gotten an iTunes and tried to play it on more than 5 computers and found that it wouldn't, that's digital rights management. If you've ever gotten an iTunes and tried to play it on a player that wasn't made by Apple and couldn't, that's digital rights management. If you've ever imported a DVD from Japan with some anime on it and put it in your American DVD player and found that it wouldn't play, again, digital rights management. If you've ever gotten a PDF and tried to copy and paste some text out of it and found that it blocked you, digital rights management. Digital rights management technologies are security technologies that treat the owners of the work and the owners of the equipment as the attackers. So traditionally, in any kind of security scenario, you have a sender and a receiver and an attacker in the middle, and you try to defend against that attacker. You take countermeasures aimed at that. There's no kind of generic security. You can only be secure from someone or something. And in this instance, the thing that you need to be secure from is the owner of the equipment, which means that by definition, the equipment has to be designed in such a way that the owner can't look inside it and improve on it. If you can imagine a business model for the auto industry in which they charge you to soup up your car and they protect it by welding the hood shut, that's the equivalent here. They want to charge you to, for example, convert the movie on your DVD into something you can watch on your iPod, and in order to do that, they have to weld the hood of your DVD player shut, right? And so with digital rights management technology, we have these technologies that treat us as attackers, and so you can never deliver them in a package that allows their users to understand, modify, and publish those modifications to them. And indeed, any time there's a digital rights management technology, there's some element of it that's licensable, or that requires a license, usually a patent or a trade secret, and that license requires you to build the technology in such a way that users can't modify it. It's usually called a compliance and robustness rule. And so as a consequence, we treat users as attackers and we shut out open source. Now, as a practical matter, this doesn't work. The reason this doesn't work is because it's like saying you've built a safe so secure that you can leave it in the bank robber's living room, right? You are the attacker, and the device is meant to defend against you, but you have unlimited and unrestricted access to the device. So it fails utterly to stop copying by itself. Now, what enables it to stop copying is the law that requires you to not publish any discoveries you make about how these safes work and what their failings are. A couple of canonical examples of that, there's a guy named Ed Felton, who's a Princeton professor. I encourage you all to read his weblog, which is called Freedom to Tinker. Those of you who are engineers will understand that freedom to tinker is a pretty important thing. Ed is a Princeton engineering professor. The music industry had emerged a specification for restricting copying of music, a watermark called the Secure Digital Watermark, Secure Digital SDMI, Secure Digital Music Initiative. And they said, this thing is so secure that if anyone can break it and tell us how they did it, we'll give them a pot of money. Ed and his grad students went through it like wet Kleenex. But instead of asking for the money and signing the non-disclosure agreement that came with it, because they were in the tradition of the Enlightenment, they chose instead to publish their outcomes at a learned conference. And so they went to a signal processing conference with their paper, and the music industry said, if you deliver your talk, we'll sue you. If you allow this talk to be delivered, we'll sue the conference, right? This math is illegal. Now, the reason they were able to do that is that in 1998, a law was passed in America called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that brings America into harmony with an international treaty called the WIPO Copyright Treaty of 1996. And this treaty says that if there is a software lock that controls access to a copyrighted work, it's unlawful to tell people how to break it, it's unlawful to tell people who they can ask how to break it, and it's unlawful to tell people where they can find out who to ask how to break it. It's unlawful to publish science in respect of it. Now, EFF, my former employer, and I exhort you all to think about joining. It's a 501c3, it's tax deductible, Electronic Frontier Foundation, went and defended Ed. Because Ed is unimpeachable and not the kind of person who turns up in court wearing black t-shirts that say things that judges don't understand, but is instead a clean-cut Princeton engineering professor, the music industry backed off because they don't want to see what the judgment that emerged would have been. But other people have found themselves in much hotter water. For example, Dmitry Skilyarov, a Russian programmer, came and gave a talk at a hacker conference. So instead of an engineering conference, it was a hacker conference. But it's the same principle. He's talking about math. The math he was talking about was the poor implementation of security in an Adobe ebook. And Adobe made all these dumb mistakes when they built the restriction systems into their ebooks. And at the end of his talk, the FBI arrested him. And the Russian State Department issued a warning to its scientists saying, don't give talks in America about math because some math there apparently is illegal and can get you thrown in jail. Right? This is, of course, the nation that gave us Lysenkoism, right? Which is, a form of science where ideology is more important than observation. So, for example, if there's an ideological theory about how wheat will grow, you embrace that theory even when the wheat doesn't grow, and anyone who points to the stubbly field and says the wheat has failed to grow is thrown in jail for violating the ideology. We have a comparable rule here, which is that you have a system that treats the owner as the attacker, puts the safe in the bank robber's living room, and if anyone points out that it doesn't work, off you go to enjoy the cell. So digital rights management technology is not science. Open source is science, and digital rights management technology is not copyright protection. There's a kind of war of words in copyright. The word intellectual property, I touched on that earlier. The word property was shoehorned into the description of what copyright was, which was until then called the author's monopoly, right? Well, author's monopoly sounds a lot less sexy than intellectual property. So about 30 years ago, a kind of concerted effort from a bunch of different players in the knowledge goods universe came up with the term and popularized it, intellectual property, because obviously property is good, monopolies are bad. If you call it property, you can get more juice out of it. So the copyright bargain says these are the rights that creators have, and except for those rights, the public has all rights to the work, right? So there's an area that's the creator's monopoly, and there's an area that belongs to the public. And in order for copyright to be modeled in a technological system, it has to reflect not just the rights that creators get, but the rights that the public get. And there are all kinds of rights that we get. If you've been in the dealer's room, you've seen mountains of used books. That's one of the most important rights that we get. It's called first sale. It allows us to dispose of our property, our physical property, not our metaphorical intellectual property, our physical goods, the books and CDs and films that we own, to dispose of them in a manner of our choosing. We can sell them, we can lend them, we can give them to our school library, we can put them in a yard sale, we can do all of those things with them. That's a right that we get under copyright. We also get the right to excerpt and quote works in the context of parody and criticism. And those of you who are involved in fanfic or in filk singing or any of those other activities that are so core to, you know, our tribe, understand that that's a pretty important flexibility, user right and copyright. But these systems don't attempt to model user rights. What they attempt to model is a kind of rent-seeking business model where you go out and you say, what can I charge money for that people have traditionally gotten for free? So for example, you might say that a work that you can sell on costs more than a work that you can get that is locked to your computer. And so you can charge people for a right that they would have gotten otherwise by default under copyright. And so if you have an iTunes, you can't sell it on. If you buy the CD, which typically costs more, you do get to sell it on, right? So you get more rights from buying CDs. And so this is not really a copyright protection system. It's kind of racketeering system. It's a system for bootstrapping a monopoly out to areas where statute has never gone, for writing private laws.
We've been listening to the first part of a speech by science fiction author and e-rights activist Cory Doctorow, delivered on February 18, 2006 at the Boscone SFCon in Boston, Massachusetts. He spoke about the global legal and technological efforts to lock down digital rights and restrict personal and creative use of electronic materials. Cory contributes to the phenomenally entertaining blog Boing Boing at boingboing.net, writes for numerous publications, and is the former European Affairs Coordinator for the Electronic Freedom Foundation. He's now a fellow of the EFF. His most recent novel is Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. Cory's website is craphound.com. You can hear the second half of Cory's talk next week or download it from the Change Surfer radio page at ieet.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.